Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights and Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Groups. It was recorded on Friday, September 6th, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group Teleform Conference Call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing national ambient air quality standards and the extent of the authority in the EPA. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome three speakers to our call. Each will make opening remarks of some 5 to 10 minutes, after which they might have a little discussion, and then ultimately, as always, questions from the audience. And as always, I'm going to be brief with my introduction since their bios have been provided to you in advance of the call. We'll hear first from Brian Mannix. He is the president of Buckland Mill Associates, and he's also a member of the Federalist Society's Executive Committee, their Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group. Second, we'll hear from Daniel Simmons. He's Director of Regulatory and State Affairs at the Institute for Energy Research. And then the last set of opening remarks will come from Professor Jonathan Adler. He's the Johann Verhage Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law in Cleveland, Ohio, and he is a member of the Executive Committee of our Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group. And with that, Mr. Mannix, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. So later this year, EPA is expected to revisit the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for ozone, which is an important standard that drives a whole range of federal and regional emissions limits, as well as state implementation plans. The Clean Air Act requires EPA to perform a de novo review every 5 years, and in doing its review, EPA considers the latest science and other new information, but it does not consider costs. Many of you may have heard Boyden Gray argue that EPA actually does consider costs and that everyone knows they do. The law simply forces them to pretend that they're not considering costs, which makes for an awkward administrative record and an opaque process. He argues we would all be better served by an administrative process and legal standard that acknowledged what everybody knows to be true. I was vividly reminded of this point when I was at EPA and was getting ready to join Administrator Steve Johnson in one of the briefings on his options for the 2008 ozone standard. As the agency's policy director, I was well aware of the work the agency had done to quantify the costs of the standards. But as we entered the room, he whispered to me, "Don't tell me what the costs are, but if it looks like I'm about to make a decision that ends civilization as we know it, please kick me under the table." He was joking, of course, but I think it highlights the sense of helplessness and unease that any conscientious EPA administrator would feel in the face of an absurd statutory mandate. This lopsided mandate to keep one eye shut resulted in a challenge to the 1998 ozone NAAQS, which reached the Supreme Court for oral argument on Election Day in 2000. The case was American Trucking Associations versus Browner, although after the Chads were counted, it was renamed Whitman. Petitioners argued in that case that Congress's charge to EPA to set standards without considering costs amounted to an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power to an administrative agency. The court rejected that argument in what may have been the last gasp of the non-delegation doctrine. But one of the amicus briefs, which became known as the Economist Brief, was interesting in that it was strikingly bipartisan. It was written by Bob Lytan and Bob Hahn, who at the time were co-directors of the AEI Brookings Center on Regulation. It was signed by 40 additional prominent economists with impressive credentials from across the political spectrum. The brief did not present a legal argument, but simply articulated the logical problems of the mandate, concluding, quote, "We believe that it would be imprudent for EPA to ignore costs totally. Not considering costs makes it difficult to set a defensible standard, especially when there is no threshold level below which health risks disappear." Some may find it surprising that such an argument would attract support across the political spectrum, but economics can sometimes work wonders. Just last week, Michael Livermore of UVA and Richard Revez of New York NYU Law School released a paper arguing 2 points. Their first point is the same one that Boyden Gray has made, and they state it compellingly. Quote, "EPA faces the choice either to impose crushing social costs, which would be politically reckless, or to determine an acceptable non-zero level of risk, an incoherent task with little connection to any socially desirable goal. For non-threshold pollutants, the agency must engage in an unstructured and unguided inquiry that divorces its stated justifications from its actual decision. The result is an elaborate obfuscation of the true reasoning underlying the agency's decision, undermining core values of the administrative state, end quote, and nicely said. Their second point is what they call the inadequacy paradox. People, including Supreme Court justices, generally assume that considering costs would cause the standards to be less stringent. Livermore and Revesz point out that in most cases, EPA's analysis shows benefits that far exceed the cost of the standards, and therefore an economically balanced standard would be more stringent than what EPA arrives at by ignoring costs. Of course, people have varying levels of confidence in the cost and benefit numbers that EPA produces, and a discussion of that topic is beyond the scope of this call. But the authors acknowledge that the benefit-cost analysis would likely change once it becomes influential, as the interested parties focus their attention on it. Just in case, Livermore and Revesz argue that the American trucking decision can be interpreted to allow EPA to determine the NACs using both methods and choose the more stringent of the two answers. I think this would strike many as a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose administrative process. At any rate, in the 13 years since the Economist brief was filed, we've had a couple of more turns of the NOx wheel, and each time the standards tend to get tighter. We also see the number of distinct standards expanding as EPA adopts separate primary and secondary standards, as it differentiates different types of particulate matter, different pathways of exposure, and so forth. The level of standards in some areas is approaching background levels of pollutants, and in some areas EPA cannot identify any feasible set of controls that might bring them into compliance, and yet that does not deter the agency. I wanted to find out if anyone had ideas for how the process might be reformed, and so earlier this year I attempted to contact the signatories of the Economist brief. This was not intended to be an opinion survey. The respondents were selected and self-selected to have a particular point of view. The goal was to see if anyone had any good ideas for how today this broken process might be reformed. Many of the 42 economists who signed the brief had substantial experience with federal policymaking. 13 have served on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. 3 have served as OMB directors, including Democrats Alice Rivlin and Charlie Schultz. 4 served as OIRA administrators. The list includes Janet Yellen, currently vice chair of the Federal Reserve, and it includes 5 Nobel laureates. Among the latter was Paul Krugman. I wasn't able to reach them all. 7 are deceased. So I expanded the list by adding other former senior officials with familiarity both with the NACs process and with the economic way of thinking. I asked if they had ideas for legislative, administrative, and judicial reforms that might fix what was broken about the NACs process. And the short answer was no. One respondent said, "I have no good ideas that the courts have not already found to be illegal." Legislatively, not much of anything is moving, and certainly no major surgery on the Clean Air Act will pass. Part of this reason is that no one will invest the effort in putting together a coalition to pass a bill, because any bill that looks like it might succeed, immediately gets hijacked as a vehicle for someone else's legislative wish list. A couple of people thought that the circumstances might become favorable for climate legislation, which could include NACs reform. Many more thought that this would not lead to anything we would recognize as reform. Administratively, it is certainly possible to find mechanisms by which some progress could be made. There is room for judgment about what is requisite to protect public health and what an adequate margin of safety is. However, it is difficult to imagine this EPA or this president taking advantage of what flexibility may remain. Executive review by the White House and OMB is hampered by the statutory and judicial deadlines, by the administrative record produced by EPA's advisory committees, and by the current president's stated view that the judgment of agency scientists should never be questioned. One comment I got is indicative, quote, "EPA staff know what they are doing, and they know that it is not science. They just call it science in order to prevent politicians and judges from better science by itself will never persuade them to back off. Judges are no more eager to second-guess EPA standard setting. Judicial review tends to focus only on compliance with prescribed procedures. Any substantive defect in the resulting standard is a problem for Congress to deal with rather than the courts. The one possible ray of hope that I got from my survey was the observation by several respondents that the states are in a position to do something. The burden of meeting the NAAQS falls primarily on the states, which it properly should. And if the NAAQS process runs off the rails, the states have both political standing and legal standing that other participants lack to challenge the process. I think Jonathan may have more to say on what legal options the states may have. Meanwhile, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Simmons.
Thanks, Brian. Brian asked me to review a paper titled "The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Assault on State Sovereignty." It's obviously a provocative title. It's from the American Legislative Exchange Council. And one of the most important things is to understand who ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is. They are a nonprofit organization for conservative state legislators. They are nonpartisan, but because they are conservative, because they have a free market view, the vast majority are Republican, and so this report is kind of it's as Brian mentioned that there is one group of people that will question what government scientists say or that will definitely question what EPA is doing, and that is state legislators. So this report was meant to educate state legislators about what is happening, because one of the biggest challenges for state legislators is that they are not subject matter experts, that many of them have been in state legislatures for just a few years. They frequently don't have year-round session in all states, so they get thrown into these legal and regulatory issues, and they're honestly in far over their heads, and so they need education, and that is the real point of this report, is to explain what is happening and what is happening with EPA, for state legislatures, one of the most important things is what EPA has been doing with the Clean Air Act and with the Clean Water Act. EPA has the authority to disapprove state implementation plans, and that authority has dramatically increased the number of times that it has exercised that authority. During the first term, 95 times they disapproved of a state plan. Compared to only 12 during President Bush's second term, which looks artificially low, and then 42 times during President Bush's first time. So even to look back to the Clinton administration was only 44 times. So there's at least been a doubling of the amount of disapprovals. And more importantly, federal governments obviously can take over the state regulatory programs with a federal implementation plans, and the number of federal implementation plans have also dramatically increased. Now, one of the most important things is that this may say that there is a new emphasis from the federal government, a new emphasis from EPA. But it can also be that there is just a difference of opinion between the federal government and between the state regulators. State regulators are obviously have to deal more with with both the benefits and the costs of these regulations, and more that is coming into conflict with EPA. One of the most interesting things about the report, and something I highly recommend that you look at, are just the visuals of EPA's or the outcome of EPA's regional haze program versus controls from various states. The states have far lower cost ways of trying to deal with regional haze. Regional haze has nothing to do with it with human health, and everything to do with just the air quality, as in haze. And so the report has some very striking pictures that show the difference between Arizona's controls, for example, and EPA's controls. And I recommend that you look at that. But something else for that's very important for state legislators to understand is that EPA how EPA's policy has been set lately when it comes to what EPA is which deadlines they're going to comply with, because as Brian mentioned, EPA has far more mandates and deadlines than they can meet. And one way that that EPA has decided which deadlines to meet is that environmental groups sue EPA over the missed deadlines, and then the settlement reaches an agreement they create a timeline for dealing with the missed deadlines. What this really means is that these lawsuits are setting policy for EPA and what EPA is going to consider, and that is that's a real problem for the states, because the states are frequently not informed. One of the big issues during the nomination hearings and the run-up to the nomination hearings for Gina McCarthy, the new EPA administrator, is over these sue and settle agreements and just the lack of notice that states had. Particularly provocative story was that the head of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection only found out about a citizen suit that affected his state's regional haze program when he read it in the Federal Register, that there had already been a settlement, not that Florida knew beforehand what had happened. And so part of the discussions that happened before McCarthy was finally confirmed was that EPA agreed to place the petitions that it receives for lawsuits on its website in some kind of a timely way. And also a very big issue, as Brian mentioned, with the ozone, the upcoming ozone NAAQS, state legislators are very concerned, the ones that know about what the ozone NAAQS could mean. And here are some numbers. In 2008, the current standard was set, and it's set at 75 parts per billion. In 2010, EPA announced that they were considering placing the new NAAQS between 60 and 70 parts per million. That was shelved for a couple years. The kind of regulatory scuttlebutt was that the EPA administrator Lisa Jackson was unhappy with putting it on the shelf, but it was more of a political decision until after the election. Now that we are after the election, there's much more talk about the upcoming ozone NAAQS. And if the NAAQS is set at 70 parts per billion, it could be that as many as 76% of U.S. counties will be out of attainment. And if it's set at 60 parts per billion, 96% of counties would be in non-attainment, and that would obviously have large impacts given the increased federal control that occurs when a county is in non-attainment. And lastly, I think it's important, especially for this report has a provocative title. I mean, the title of the U.S. EPA's assault on state sovereignty. And one of the most important things I think for state legislators to understand, and for federal legislators as well, is that this isn't necessarily a result of bad motives. It is the result of it's the way the law is currently written, and it's what happens with all bureaucracies. People like to protect their jobs. People like to think that the thing that they do is the most important thing. And when EPA isn't forced to consider the costs and benefits, we reach the situation we are today, where the costs of these programs will greatly exceed any benefits, because from the guys at EPA, what they're doing is the most important thing. And unfortunately, by doing what they think is the most important thing, it tramples on state sovereignty. Jonathan?
All righty. Well, thank you, Dan and Brian. As I think already become clear. Under the Clean Air Act, the EPA imposes ambient air quality standards on states and localities that those states and localities would often not adopt on their own. And that this is not simply an effort by the federal government to prevent upwind jurisdictions from polluting downwind jurisdictions, but is in fact aimed in effect at protecting individual jurisdictions from themselves. That is, the federal government says that, that it has determined that the proper level of air quality that all Americans must have is at a certain threshold, and that all parts of the country must meet that without regard for the cost. So states wouldn't do this voluntarily. But the interesting thing about air pollution control is that while the EPA is in the position of imposing the ultimate standard that has to be met, EPA is not capable of implementing the various emission control restrictions necessary to meet these standards on its own. And for this reason, the Clean Air Act adopts what we often refer to as a cooperative federalism model, although, as I'll explain in a moment, it's really not very cooperative. But it adopts a model whereby the federal government encourages state and local government, states in particular, to cooperate with the federal goals and to actually do the lion's share of the on-the-ground implementation. That is typically state officials that issue the air quality permits, that run the vehicle emission inspection programs, that adopt the various adopt and enforce the specific measures that are necessary to at least attempt to achieve an air quality standard. And the EPA, or for that matter, no federal agency, is allowed to simply command the state government to cooperate with the federal regulatory scheme. As the Supreme Court has made clear on numerous occasions, the federal government may not commandeer states to implement a federal regulatory scheme. This is true whether we're talking about federal regulations governing the proper disposal of low-level radioactive waste or a federally imposed requirement for background checks on the purchase of handguns, or in this case, the imposition of emission controls necessary to meet a federal air quality standard. If the federal government wants, or as is the case with air quality control, air pollution control needs state cooperation, it has to find a way to induce that cooperation voluntarily. And so the model the Clean Air Act adopts, like many other federal statutes, is that it imposes various conditions upon the receipt of federal money. And if states want to receive that money, they have to hum along to EPA's tune. Now, under many statutes, this sort of structure is very straightforward. The federal government says, you can have money to do X so long as you do X our way. And in many contexts, that's enough to get states to play along. In the Clean Air Act context, that's not enough, and Congress realized that was not enough. So Congress adopted a much more aggressive and ambitious approach. And under the Clean Air Act, the states risk losing all or virtually all of their federal highway funds if they fail to adopt implementation plans that EPA believes will achieve the federal air quality standard. And this is a significant amount of money. It's not the amount of money that's at stake with, say, Medicaid and the like, but for quite a few states, it exceeds 5% of their annual budget. It can be quite significant, particularly in low population, large geography states where highway funding is particularly important. And what's interesting as a constitutional matter is that this power to induce state cooperation has limits. And the reason the Supreme Court has said it has limits was because if it didn't, then Congress could simply attach every condition at once to receipt of all federal money and could essentially go through the motions of giving states a choice but actually be engaging in commandeering through the back door. So in a case called Dole, the Supreme Court articulated a set of limits. And these limits are that the money must be for the general welfare. That's not really an important limit. the Supreme Court's never even suggested what could violate that. The Supreme Court has said that the condition that's imposed on the receipt of money cannot violate an independent constitutional bar. The other limits, though, are particularly interesting. One is that there must be a sufficient relationship between the condition and the purpose of the money. Congress couldn't say require states to adopt a drinking age and attach that to, say, Medicaid funding or PILT payments for federal properties. I mean, that would not there would not be a relationship there. States also must have notice. That is to say, they must know what the conditions are that they are agreeing to. The court has often said that conditional funding offers are much like a contract and must be treated as such, and that states have to be aware of the conditions. And then finally, the Supreme Court has said, and it's not always clear in some of the court's opinions whether this is an independent requirement or this is merely a gloss on the other four requirements taken as a whole, it is said that the inducement cannot be so great as to be coercive. Now, some people have argued the Clean Air Act had a problem with this test. I've had a problem with this test for some time, and I have an article from, gosh, probably almost 10 years ago now that laid out that case. But the problem is that the Supreme Court had never actually struck anything down on this test. It announced the test, it reaffirmed the test, but every time something came up for challenge, it let it go through. Up until the healthcare litigation, now up until NFIB versus Sebelius, where the court held that Congress could not condition the receipt of traditional Medicaid money on a state's willingness to expand Medicaid and expand Medicaid with a whole new pot of money from the federal government. The court said it was okay for Congress to say, if you want new Medicaid money, you got to do the new Medicaid dance. But old Medicaid is separate, and you can't leverage the participation in one program or money for an old program on participation in a new program. And in doing so, the court stressed the amount of money at stake, which admittedly was quite substantial, but also stressed this leveraging of money for one purpose to achieve a separate purpose, and then also emphasized that receipt of money is in the nature of a contract, and that the federal government can't play a game of gotcha. It can't give states money for a period of time on one set of conditions and then suddenly change the rules. And I think this case dramatically strengthens the argument that the highway fund sanctions under the Clean Air Act are unconstitutional and may not be enforced by the EPA against states that refuse to adopt implementation plans that will meet the next. And I say this for several reasons. First, just as a matter of signaling, the fact that the Supreme Court has finally put teeth into the Dole test and been willing to strike something down, and to strike something down as significant as portions of the Affordable Care Act, signals to lower courts that this is something they have to pay attention to. But substantively, it's important because the gap between the sorts of things that states have to do under the Clean Air Act, regulating stationary sources, modifying their own state court rules for citizen suit standing to challenge the issuance of permits given to factories and so on, the gap between that and highway funding is quite large, certainly far greater than the gap between old Medicaid and new Medicaid in terms of purpose and relationship. But then also the nature of the NAAQS program, as Brian related, is such that the rules that states must meet, both quantitatively, the thresholds they must reduce emissions to get the air quality to meet the federal standard, but also the sorts of measures that must be taken, is a constantly moving target. In fact, the Act requires the EPA to be constantly revising this. And so the state that becomes reliant upon federal highway money today has no ability to predict let alone account for the sorts of conditions that may be imposed on the state in the future. And so on this basis as well, I think that the highway sanctions portions of the Clean Air Act could not be constitutionally enforced. And even though the money at stake is less, it is still substantial, quite substantial, and actually approaching the level of Medicaid funding for some states. But the notice problem and the relatedness problem is far greater. So I think that As a practical matter, some states are likely to see the difficulty of complying with not existing NAAQS standards, Titan's NAAQS standards, as being so great that they are likely to challenge the enforceability of the highway fund sanction. And I think that they would have quite a strong argument should states seek to advance that claim. I will stop there and turn it back to you, Dean.
Thank you very much. I do want to open the floor to questions. Before we do that, I want to do two things. First, let me make an announcement about next week's schedule, at least as it exists right now. On Monday, we'll have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum looking at the Verizon versus FCC case being argued earlier that day in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That case involves the extent of the FCC's authority to regulate the Internet. And then on Tuesday, we will host a Teleforum conference call at 3 p.m., looking at the New Mexico Supreme Court decision concerning the photographer's rights with regard to not photographing or having to photograph a gay commitment ceremony. That's Tuesday at 3 p.m. For a more complete schedule, obviously visit the Federal Society's website, and as always, be alert to emails coming to you announcing additional Teleforum conference calls. The second thing I wanted to do before I open the floor to questions is go back to our earlier presenters, in particular Brian Mannix or Daniel Simmons, and see if they have anything to add, if you want to revise and extend your remarks before we go to the audience.
Nope.
Brian, do you have anything further?
This is Dan Simmons. One thing that I would add, and this is not a it's not a legal issue. It's just a just the difficulty of amending the Clean Air Act. One of the most important things about air quality in the United States is that it's dramatically improved since the beginning of the Clean Air Act. Since 1980 alone, aggregate U.S. emissions are down. Aggregate pollutants. Aggregate emissions of pollutants are down 67%, and it becomes very difficult to for Congress to amend the law when they look at the when you look at air quality and the fact that it is increasing, regardless of the cost. Now, obviously, Brian makes some very good arguments about the cost and about how this can be done for less for much less, but it is important to consider that we have ever-improving air quality, and because of that, the cost of making the next marginal improvement become much, much more expensive.
Very good. Well, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. At that point, to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So let's do that now. So once again, if you have a question for any of our three experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Like our audience, it looks like, is not yet engaged, gentlemen. Again, if you have a question for either of our experts, any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Well, Brian, we've got quite a few people on the line. I don't know why they're not asking questions. I wonder if you want to just take it from here, maybe pose a question or two to Jonathan or Dan or
or say something outrageous to get the audience worked up and calling in.
Do.
No,
say something newsworthy, Brian.
I know. I think Dan makes a good point that the Clean Air Act is a successful statute. And that success is visible to much of the population. And I also think it's right, as Jonathan discussed, that this kind of federalist cooperation between the federal government and the states is the right way to approach something like the regulation of the criteria pollutants subject to NAAQS. Most of the most of the damage from the, they're not global pollutants like CO2 is alleged to be. They act for the most part locally. There are some interstate effects, and we have mechanisms for dealing with that. But for the most part, the problems and the solutions are to be found locally. At the same time, it makes sense for a national agency like EPA to be looking at all the evidence, looking at the science, and setting some ground rules and some information about, you know, what are the risks associated with these pollutants, so that everybody can see that and everybody can react to it. So the federal structure of the Clean Air Act is right. I think the, you know, a major defect is this lack of considering costs. I also think that you can't just fix it. I mean, if I could wave a magic wand and change the statute to say, okay, EPA, consider costs, I would hesitate before waving it, because I think there's a lot of work to be done in fixing not only the analysis of costs, but also the analysis of benefits associated with clean air, because I don't think we're doing it right now. And I think we need to improve them a lot before we can rely on them to set standards.
I'm wondering of maybe Dan Simmons and Professor Adler, is some attempt to assess costs and benefits, even if it's not done in the best way possible, is that better than no attempt? In other words, should there be some kind of requirement to at least attempt to assess costs and benefits? As a non-expert in this area, it seems to me odd that a federal government agency would be allowed to promulgate regulations without considering the costs and benefits. It seems to me that's precisely the kind of analysis you want to engage in before imposing a regulatory requirement on the country.
And this is Dan Simmons. I definitely think that even if the analysis of costs and benefits are flawed, that it is at least good to have the exercise. There was I wish I remembered the story better. There was a few months ago EPA produced some rule, and unfortunately that's all I can remember, is that it was some rule, and they included some types of benefits, and they sent that rule to the Office of Management and Budget, and the Office of Management and Budget, when they reviewed the rule, they struck whatever those alleged benefits were from the rule. They disagreed with EPA's analysis, and because of that, there was an activist who said, this is tragic, because it means that this rule will not now become law. And the reality is, there was nothing to stop the federal government from going ahead with the rule, even if it didn't make cost benefit sense. The point of cost and benefits frequently is to just be able to look at cost and benefits, but there's nothing actually stopping the federal government from not implementing the rule, even if it shows even if the costs are larger than the benefits. And as Brian had mentioned earlier, the costs and benefits aren't the way they do it is there is definitely problems. One of the more expensive rules over the past few years has been the mercury and air toxic standards. That rule costs about $10 billion, nearly $10 billion a year, and that's according to EPA, for the cost of reducing mercury emissions. When you read the analysis of that, it turns out that the benefits of reducing mercury emissions are only about $500,000 a year. From those two facts, you would think, well, obviously the costs far outweigh the benefits. But then what EPA did in their analysis is that they said, well, the pollution control technologies to reduce mercury also will reduce particulate matter emissions. That's very, very small dust, essentially. But it will reduce particulate matter emissions. And those co-benefits then will create essentially benefits of more than $10 billion a year, and therefore this rule has the benefits are greater than the costs. And that one example shows that there are some, I don't know if you want to say shenanigans, but there are some ways that EPA and other federal agencies can kind of possibly skew their analysis to kind of get the answer that they want. That these aren't cost benefit analyses aren't perfect, but they're definitely better than nothing.
Professor Adler, we've got a couple questions now lined up from the audience. Do you want to weigh in here, or should we turn to the audience?
Just really quickly. I mean, I think that too many people look at cost benefit analysis as a panacea to the problem of unduly burdensome environmental regulation. And I think, you know, as both Dan and Brian mentioned, doing a cost benefit analysis of something like an air quality standard requires making a range of judgment calls. It requires deciding how conservative one wants to be with the health assessments and so on. And it requires making judgments about how to monetize things that are not easily monetizable. So I don't think cost benefit as a trigger or a threshold makes sense. I think requiring agencies to do what in effect they're required to do by NEPA, that is to identify the likely consequences, both good and bad, of a given action, so that the public is aware of at least how the agency sees the trade-offs, is beneficial and useful. And I think in particular in the Clean Air Act, what the part of the problem is that in different parts of the country, people weigh these trade-offs differently. As we all know, California has far more stringent environmental regulations than most of the rest of the country. It has always, or for the last 4.5 to 5 decades, has been more aggressive than the federal government or the vast majority of states in pursuing air pollution control. And so California is going to weigh these trade-offs differently than other parts of the country. And it's also going to face different trade-offs in the rest of the country because the types of things you must do, for example, in Los Angeles County to reduce ozone emissions are different than the things you would do here in Cleveland, where I am, or in Atlanta, or in Houston, or in Chicago, and so on. And so one thing we may want to think about is getting away from the idea that a one-size-fits-all trade-off between the cost of meeting a particular environmental goal and the benefits of that goal makes sense, and that allowing different parts of the country to weigh those trade-offs differently is actually a much more rational way to go about addressing these sorts of policy questions.
Very good. We've got two questions lined up. Again, if you would like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our audience for its first question.
Hi, this is Leo Dombrowski in Chicago. In addition to the cost-benefit analysis that EPA or other people may have done regarding a reduction in the ozone standard, has anyone tried to quantify number of jobs this might cost? We're all supposed to be so concerned with the number of manufacturing jobs in the manufacturing base in this country. But if the standard goes down to 70 and 60, God forbid, and we have essentially the entire country being non-attainment for ozone, do we know what, if it's going to be so much harder to open up a plant or expand a plant, is there any quantification as to what that all might mean?
Yes, this is Brian. Since we got a glimpse of what EPA is thinking for the new ozone standard, the 60 or 70 parts per billion, in 2011, I think, the Manufacturers Alliance did an analysis of exactly the impact you're talking about. You can find it at mapi.net. And if I recall correctly, they did show substantial job losses. I'm not one who puts a lot of faith in estimates of job gains and job losses, but they do have an estimate of job losses there. They also did an estimate of cost that was very different from EPA's. I think EPA's was on the order of $80 billion, and MAPI did an estimate closer to $1 trillion annually once the standards were fully effective. which is something like 4 or 5% of GDP. So yeah, it's an interesting analysis, and they arrived at very different conclusions from EPA. Michael Greenstone at Brookings has also been doing research on this topic, and I'd suggest Googling his name and seeing what you find there. He was a member of the Obama Council of Economic Advisors and has been on the staff there, engaged with EPA in improving benefit cost analysis, the way they do it.
Yeah, I'll just, if I bring that in, I'm somewhat worried about prospective studies with trying to estimate job loss because there are so many variables that are hard to account for. But retrospective studies, those that are any good, and there aren't very many that are very good, but those that are particularly good have found significant job losses. Michael Greenstone, who, as Brian mentioned, was the chief economist for President Obama's CEA during the first term, did a study several years ago that looked at plants located in non-attainment areas versus attainment areas over the period of 1972 through 1987, and he found that a loss of about 600,000 jobs compared to what would have happened without the regulations imposed by non-attainment status. And that study, I think, is really one of the most sophisticated and precise studies of the kind that we've seen. People can argue whether or not 600,000 jobs is a lot of jobs or a few jobs, but I think it is significant. And it was Dr. Greenstone's paper on this, I think, was quite sophisticated.
Yep. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, this is Darren Bax from Heritage Foundation calling. One quick question, and then another, maybe the second one being a little longer. I guess the first question is, any idea when we think the ozone standard might come out?
I don't have any inside information on that. There's been a lot of speculation, but the thinking is this year.
So would it be kind of like it would just come out, or would they have to be reproposed?
It would have to be proposed. Yeah.
It would have to be proposed again? Okay. Let me ask, and hopefully this will make some sense. I'm not sure if it will. Even when, if EPA doesn't take into account the associated costs of the science, and you're just trying to develop a standard based on the latest science, in some way, even when the agency is doing that, they ultimately are figuring out, built into that analysis is ultimately some type of cost analysis, even if they're not even thinking about it, in a sense that they are they're going to push a standard as strict as they can that is politically feasible, because any type of science is going to show or that a certain amount of ozone is going to cause at least some cases of asthma, for example, even with background levels, might cause potential harm, theoretically, for some type of harm, not necessarily asthma, whatever it might be. So you have kind of a less transparent scenario with cost analysis because you're trying to say that cost shouldn't be considered. If you actually allow cost to be considered in the first place, it might be just a better process. I mean, do you think that there's kind of this cost analysis actually going on even though it's not supposed to be?
I think that's right. That's the point Boyd and Gray made, and in their own way, Livermore and Revez made it. And having been inside the agency, I do think it's true that people are not – I mean, nobody in the agency wants to go to zero. They know that there's no known reason why we would want to be breathing some of these pollutants, and yet they don't set a standard of zero. And those decisions are always couched in terms of what we know about public health, what the uncertainty is at the lower dose levels, what's an adequate margin of safety. But I think people are, in the back of their minds, making calculations about what the cost would be of going too far. The problem is that everybody's thinking about that differently. The administrator may have one thing on his or her mind that she's worried about. The legal staff may be worrying about vulnerability. If they set a zero standard, they'd wind up in court in a big hurry, and the court would say, well, this is infeasible, and we're going to have to reinterpret the Clean Air Act for you. People are worried about political risks of various kinds, small p politics and large p politics. But you won't find that in the administrative record, and that I think is a difficulty in that people are not explaining what they're thinking really is and arriving at a number.
Sorry, just to follow up. I mean, even if we look at what the science says, and we're just looking at the science, it doesn't necessarily give you a particular, and it's just a follow-up, it doesn't give you the particular answer, the policy conclusion as to, okay, what then is the level? What are we going to accept?
Safe level, that's not a scientific question. Science cannot tell you what the safe level is. It is a policy question, and yet the scientists view it as all well within their domain. The Clean Air Science Advisory Committee is actually charged with giving advice on the level of the standard. It's not prohibited from taking policy considerations into account. And yet, when they present these decisions or recommendations, they present them as this is what the science tells us, and pretend that there are no policy considerations intruding.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Gentlemen, it looks like we've run through the questions to the audience. I'm going to give each of you just a minute or two, really, to express any final thoughts or wrap up, and let's go in the same order we started with.
Well, I'll just express the wish that as we go through this next round of rulemaking on ozone and the other NAAQS standards that are in the queue, that as the states realize what it means for them, what it means administratively for them to implement the standards, what it means for the economy of the counties that will fall into non-attainment, what it means for jobs in their state, that they view themselves as protagonists, that they're not just bystanders, they're not helpless, they're really in a better position than anyone else to say, hey, this is excessive, this is not the deal we entered into, and something's got to change, that an administrative agency should not be able to jerk around a state legislature without, somebody at the federal level sitting down and thinking about what the consequences are, whether it be the Congress or the agency. Somebody has to keep in mind those costs when they make these decisions.
And I would just like to echo what Brian said, and add that it's very possible. I thought the rumor was that the administration is going to propose that ozone standard of 65 parts per billion. I have no idea if that's actually true, but that would be incredibly costly. And one of the most difficult things in Washington is to amend a bedrock environmental law like the Clean Air Act. It is incredibly difficult. Almost all large pieces of legislation, there's only one example of a large piece of environmental legislation that wasn't passed in a bipartisan manner. And bipartisanism is awfully very difficult in Washington these days. And so I think it's really unfortunately up to the states to exercise their prerogative with these upcoming environmental regulations to be better heard and to actually influence the process more than they have in the past.
Professor Adler.
Yeah, I was just picking up on that. I think states are in a good position to influence this process in part because, unlike the EPA, the states right now bear the brunt of these decisions, and that it's the states that actually have to develop and implement and enforce the plans that are required under the Clean Air Act to comply with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. The fact that states resist this should in and of itself be an indication that, at least for much of the country, the NAAQS standards do not make sense and do not pass the cost-benefit test for those that bear the costs and stand to reap the benefit. But as I tried to point out, especially in light of the Supreme Court's NFIB versus Sebelius decision, the states are in a position to dramatically shift the negotiations between states and the federal government about what qualifies as an adequate implementation plan, because the states, I think, have the ability to disarm the biggest threat that the EPA has, which is the threat to take away highway money if states don't play along. And as I said, if EPA tightens the standard, it would not surprise me at all if some states go to court to try and do just that.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been an interesting discussion. I certainly appreciate your time and your expertise. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call. Again, that's Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be discussing in a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum the Verizon versus FCC case concerning FCC authority to regulate the Internet. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.